Hey everyone, and welcome to Chef AJ Live. I'm your host, Chef AJ, and this is where I introduce you to amazing people like you who are doing great things in the world that I think you should know about. Well, today's the first Thursday of the month, which means it's time for healthy skin and glowing from within with our plant-based dermatologist, Dr. Jessica Krant, where she answers the questions that you sent in advance. So be sure to subscribe to chefaj.com because every Saturday morning, we send you the schedule of the speakers, the mostly doctors for the week, so that you just reply to it with your questions, because it's really hard to take questions live from the chat, especially when we multi-stream like seven places at once. Please welcome Dr. Jessica Krant. How have you been?
Hi, Chef AJ. It's so great to be with you as always. And I've been good. I'm really happy about springtime coming around and the weather warming up a little bit. We've had a couple of sunny, beautiful days in New York City. So that's been great.
Yeah, spring is my favorite season for sure, because it's not as hot as summer and it's not as cold as fall and winter. And I was born in the spring, so I love spring too.
I think I was too in May. Yeah.
I consider you a spring baby.
Yeah.
So anything new in the world of skin?
Nothing that actually is coming to mind just as you ask me that, but always the same, just more and more revelations over the months and over the years that our lifestyle, our food choices, our stress management, our sleep habits all affect skin health, not only for inflammatory skin conditions and autoimmune skin conditions, but also for anti-aging. So it's just so easy for me to spread that message because it's always true. And we're just getting more and more evidence.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question then, because, you know, I've done almost 2000 shows of Chef AJ Live in the past 5 years, mostly medical doctors. And one of the things that's coming up in the world today is Ozempic, and they all look at it from the perspective of, you know, their specialty. What have you seen in the world of dermatology as a result of people taking this drug, if anything?
I haven't personally had a lot of patients in my own practice right lately who are taking these medications, but I do know there's chatter in the dermatology community about the potential benefit of some of these medications in our patients who, for example, have diabetes or metabolic syndrome, because not only does obesity and carrying excess weight create an inflammatory milieu in the body that can be associated with some inflammatory skin conditions, but also chronically high insulin running around the body and other features of diabetes do affect the skin as well. Polycystic ovarian syndrome is another example where these medications may eventually play a role in helping people to, at least at first, start regulating their metabolism and the way that their metabolism functions. And it can potentially help people to reduce that total body inflammation and help insulin to work more effectively, which helps reduce lots of inflammatory skin conditions from acne to rosacea to hidradenitis suppurativa. Potentially psoriasis is proven to be linked with carrying excess weight, and also potentially even eczema. So anything inflammatory will probably improve and may, you know, get a real boosting effect from Ozempic and other drugs like that.
I guess what I meant, though, is what effect does it have on the skin? For example, we've heard of this thing called Ozempic face.
Well, it does cause weight loss. So it will cause thinning and loss of what we colloquially call baby fat in the cheeks. And it can lead to a little bit of a thinned out look. That's true of any excess weight loss, though. And also, you know, in the very old days, for example, in the days of HIV and AIDS, when AZT, the first medication that really worked, came on the market, a lot of people had facial changes that were associated with the loss of the fat or in the face, in a way that really was surprising and people didn't expect. So we're always going to be on the lookout for facial effects of systemic medications. And this is one we're just going to have to track and see what happens.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, we'll jump in right away to the viewers' questions, and thank you guys for sending them. The first one is from, I can't tell who it's from, but that's okay. I will email you when we answer it. And that's what's great about this feature of sending it. I don't personally email you, but we do tell you when it's been answered because we have archived them. And this is about yeast growth. The person wants to know what causes yeast growth and what is your suggestion for treatment? I'm now using shampoo and treatment daily as needed. It's help, but I need extra help.
Yeast is a whole family of microorganisms, and there are a few that are normal flora on our skin and our scalps. One of them is called Pityrosporum ovale, and that is one that is always there, and everybody has it. But when we talk about the microbiome, we're very used to now talking about the gut microbiome and all the balance of the microbes in the gut. That includes bacteria, yeast, fungi, other microorganisms that don't fit into those three categories. On the skin, we also have a microbiome that is, when the skin is healthy, that microbiome is in balance. So those yeasts are always there, but when they act up, it can be because there's triggers causing excess inflammation, or it can be because something about the microbiome becomes imbalanced. For example, if topical antibiotics or systemic antibiotics are used too much, it kills bacteria but can allow yeast to develop. When I have patients who are on a lot of antibiotic type treatments for acne, maybe even from other providers, or if we've been doing an antibacterial program for a short while, we have to be careful and make sure that little red bumps and itchy spots that are forming are not caused by the now excessive balance of the yeast compared to the bacteria. On the scalp, Pityrosporum becoming overgrown can lead to inflammation, which can lead to flakiness, oiliness, and even little small pimples. And we call that seborrheic dermatitis. That's the medical term would be dandruff, the medical term for dandruff caused by this yeast. So people who feel that they have an excess of yeast on the scalp may need to use truly anti-yeast medicated shampoos, the actual dandruff shampoos. It may not be enough to use tea tree shampoos and other types of more natural shampoos for a while, because tea tree is a general antiseptic. It sort of kills a lot of microbes a little bit, but it may not be enough to restore the balance of the microbiome. So, itching from the yeast can be treated by killing the yeast and also by reducing the inflammation. Sometimes that requires a topical steroid for a short while, treating the scalp gently, not scrubbing it too much.
Wow.
One interesting thing I would like to note is that there's a lot of social media out there telling people to not only use these extremely natural, gentle shampoos, but also to wash their hair less often. Because they claim that washing too much is drying and it's causing scalps to be dry. I actually suspect that the opposite may be true, where the hair itself, the hair strands may get drier depending on your hair from a lot of washing. But when we underwash the scalp and we don't remove dead skin cells, excess oil, and even remove or kill the yeast that builds up, the scalp becomes flaky and itchy, and it's not from being dry. It's from the buildup of the oils and the yeast. So I submit that social media juggernaut of wash your hair once a week or less is actually wrong. And if people are feeling itchy on the scalp, the first thing to try is to actually wash more. And I would say, even don't be as afraid of traditional shampoos and dandruff shampoos as some communities would like to have people believe. If you're feeling itchy, try your old-fashioned shampoo that you used to love and see what happens.
Interesting. Thank you. This is from Charlene, and she says, "What causes nocturnal itching? I'm a 71-year-old following a plant-based diet. I have no rash, just itching on my face, mostly trunk. I usually get up and take an antihistamine so I can get back to sleep, but I would prefer not to take it."
There is massive amounts of research right now in micro biochemistry, what's happening inside the body, in the nerves, and in the chemical signaling in the body that causes itch. The industry of research on itch is massive right now, and they're having huge breakthroughs. And there are actually some new creams and other medications coming out that directly impact the itch pathway. We don't know all of the causes for itching, but it turns out there are many, many causes. And some of them are really tricky and difficult to get a handle on. I will say that it's normal that itching rises up in the evening.
Okay.
That is normal.
She says it's mostly her scalp, face, and neck.
Right. And I thought also maybe she said trunk or something like
Yeah, true.
that. Yeah. So that's the whole upper body. So that can be something related to, for example, this seborrhea that we were just talking about. It could be a little bit of yeast. It could be a reaction to a medication. It could be nerve related, and it could also be hormone related. It can be a postmenopausal itching that can rise up in the evening. And for some people, I've actually had people had a patient with prickly feeling on the face and neck that turned out to actually be a vitamin B12 deficiency. So it could be many, many things. I was just wanting to say that for that people who are surprised that it actually feels more itchy in the evening, that's normal. And part of the reason that happens is that during the day, our cortisol hormone level, which is the hormone that wakes us up in the morning and keeps us going throughout the day, our stress hormone that rises when we have times of acute stress and we need to be able to power through, that cortisol level normally starts to wane in the evening and go down because that is what allows us to be able to get to sleep. When cortisol is high, that's like our body's natural steroid. And we all know that steroids fight itch. So during the day, that itching is sort of tamped down and masked by the cortisol. In the evening, when our cortisol levels go down and the itch feeling starts to rise up, it's not a surprise. And that's a normal pattern for itching. What is causing the itching, I would not be able to tell in this setting.
She says she uses Cetaphil as a cleanser, but only on her body.
So Cetaphil has always been a traditionally very marketed as a very gentle cleanser. And for some people, they use it for decades and it's great. I have had a few patients who have had a facial rash, especially around the eyelids, a little bit itchy, a little bit burny. And when we took away their Cetaphil cleanser, it got better. So it might be worth trying a different gentle cleanser for a while, potentially.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you. This is from Nicole. Help. I'm allergic to mosquitoes and they are eating me alive. The dermatologist put me on oral and topical steroids, but I know I can't take them forever. Any advice?
I don't have a pat answer for this. I know that there are a lot of ideas about how to repel mosquitoes. And I would say, it would take just researching those and trying all of them and maybe multiple at once. The ultrasonic ones, the fragrance ones, I don't really know, other than, trying to get the mosquitoes to stay away is really your best bet.
Yeah, but how do you do that?
Right. And I'm just not enough of a bug bite expert to know off the top of my head, but this is the good season to answer that.
Well, you know how you said that there's certain dermatologists that kind of specialize in nails and hair. So they have like a mosquito dermatologist somewhere
You
or a
know, I mean the real answer to that is there are probably tropical medicine doctors. I mean, there are tropical medicine doctors, They have a lot to do with travel medicine and vaccination for travel, but they would know about mosquito management, especially because people have to travel to countries with endemic malaria and things like that. So a tropical medicine doctor may have real good answers about keeping mosquitoes away.
Nice. That's great advice right there. Thank you. This is from Deborah. I'm 62, strictly vegan for 13 years, virtually exclusively whole foods, oil free for almost 4 years, and my face is very pimply. It really is quite yucky. Any explanations or suggestions so I could try to get back to a more blemish free face? I only use moisturizer and face wash and basically no makeup except for special occasions around my eyes.
Of course, this is a very important question. Also, hard for me to answer without more detail, without an in-person exam. But not all red bumps on the face are caused by acne vulgaris, which is the Latin term for common acne. Some red bumps are rosacea, and some red bumps are yeast folliculitis. That pterosporum can get into the skin and cause bumps, which we, if we treat them as acne, actually they'll get worse because we tend to kill bacteria and allow yeast to grow, which can make them worse. So making sure to be avoiding things like coconut oil on the face or any other tropical oils would be a good step. A lot of people are using coconut oil as a natural moisturizer. It's actually comedogenic. It causes pimples. So I would make sure to avoid that and make sure that the skin is, as she said that she does use a moisturizer, which is important because a lot of people want to dry out pimples and dry them out and dry them out. And that actually irritates the skin and creates more pimples. Other than that, I would say, unfortunately, it might entail a few trips to a dermatologist because we don't always know on the first visit, but we may have to try things over time to see what can help. And I know people are writing in hoping that I can solve these questions, but unfortunately, it sometimes takes an in-person exam and some more investigation. And also, I can't really give personal medical advice on our show here, as we know, since I'm nobody's personal doctor. So I can't actually give specific advice, but these are just some ideas that may apply in general.
Yeah, no, we always make sure the disclaimer is in the show notes for every single show. So thank you. This is from Katie in Tucson. I'm 65 and spent half my life trying to get a tan in California, a blue-eyed blonde. I failed miserably despite numerous blistering sunburns. I now find myself with old lady skin on my forearms, the kind that bruises with long-term, difficult-to-resolve red marks, which take forever to fade. My question is there any way to improve the appearance of these marks?
Well, Katie, you're not alone. This is so normal and so common. I would say ingredients that you might find in lotions that could help to thicken the skin up a little bit, and make it a little more resilient would include things like glycolic acid, urea, maybe a retinoid like retinol, a body lotion with some retinol, of course, sunscreen, and lots of rich moisturizer because it does help the skin to be a little thicker and juicier. And that all will help the skin to repair itself more quickly. As we get older, when we lose estrogen, the skin gets thinner and thinner and it's just less hydrated. So it communicate, the signals, the molecular signals for repairing everything slow down too. So the retinoid, the glycolic acid, urea, of course, sunscreen, and lots of moisturizer twice a day are a good place to start.
Thank you. Next question from Sandra. Have you heard of Skin Sobering by Dr. Erin Hewitt, TGAM? Her book and website say that the Uesugi Skin Sobering Method is based on science, which has proven that not using skincare products results in healthier and better looking skin. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how not using skincare product affects your skin. And then she gives a website, skinsobering.com.
It is true that excessive cleansing, excessive scrubbing, excessive exfoliating do throw off our skin's natural defensive barriers, natural microbiome balance. For some people, our skin is able to use that kind of injury to robustly go into repair mode and end up better than it was. But for some people, doing too much throws the balance off, creates inflammation, and is worse. So the skin sobering method may work for some people because it allows the skin's natural order to replenish itself and recreate the what we call the acid mantle, which is the low pH protective barrier of the skin's natural moisturizer layer. But for some people, going completely natural makes them worse. Now, it could be argued that for those people, maybe changing lifestyle may help, or eating more flax, ground flax seeds may help, but everybody's so individual. So I'm not against anyone trying the skin sobering method. I just don't think that it will automatically work for everybody with just doing that. I'm not against it.
Okay, perfect. Next, this is Heidi. What are your thoughts on the Virtue RF microneedling? Is it worth spending the money? If yes, do you recommend doing it on a regular basis after the first round in order to preserve benefits, or could there be long-term consequences and even damage to the skin?
I cannot comment on the Virtue RF brand. I don't know about that device. I can comment a little bit about the concept of the treatment, the device. The concept of it is called radiofrequency microneedling. That's the RF is radio frequency. And what that means is it's a device, all of them, all of the radio frequency microneedling devices have various types of small little needle tips, like a microneedling pen, that punch a little hole, punch holes through the skin surface, and while the needle tips are under the surface, deliver a small pulse of radio frequency energy, that's radio waves, at such a degree that they create heat. It's just another form of delivering injury to the dermis, which is under the surface. The theory is that when we create these micro injuries, which we do with laser, we do with microneedling, and we do with microneedling that delivers energy under the surface, like radio frequency microneedling, the injuring the collagen should trigger wound repair and new collagen being formed. If this works perfectly and the needles are as tiny as they should be, and the energy only gets delivered underneath at the right level and the right amount of energy at the right depth, it can create it's definitely temporary tightening at first that does relax back, but also some longer term new collagen formation, which does help keep the skin plumper, juicier, and a little tighter. The microneedling happening on the very surface does act like microneedling, like a little microneedling facial, which can help create new cells, get increased cell turnover, and create a glow. So if it all works perfectly, depending on which device and who is operating it, there can be some benefit. Is there benefit to doing a treatment, a perfectly delivered treatment for your skin type every few months over years? Probably. But there are risks and downsides. First of all, it can be very uncomfortable. It can cost a lot of money. And there is a risk of scarring the skin. If the heat is delivered too superficially, it will scar the skin and if the handle is pulled out too quickly, it can leave dots in the skin. So face and neck are common areas to treat, maybe chest. Again, depending on whose hands these devices are in, how meticulous the technique is, and how patiently it is delivered, and which device it is, it can be of benefit, but there are also risks.
Are there any procedures that across the board you recommend people avoid?
Well, no, not really. Some lasers and some energy delivering devices that deliver heat are more risky and potentially scarring for people with darker skin types. So you would really have to research the wavelength of laser being used. And I will ignore that squirrel. And make sure that you're seeing a board certified dermatologist, a board certified plastic surgeon, ideally who are operating the devices themselves. Somebody really, really experienced with the settings, with that device, with your skin type. So many things can go wrong. People are burned, getting burned left and right these days in med spas and places where people think they understand the devices, but they really don't know how to make the decisions for each individual patient. But there's something that's right for everybody. And I couldn't say blanket, there is a device that I don't think anyone should use.
Okay. Thanks. This is from Karen. What are Dr. Krantz's thoughts on topical vitamin C, and what are the benefits from using it, and which vitamin C is best?
Lots of competition in the market these days for the newer, more modern formulations of vitamin C that are supposedly more stable in the bottle. Vitamin C is ascorbic acid. It's the vitamin that comes from citrus and also bell peppers and other brightly colored fruits and vegetables. It is a building block for collagen. So when people ask me about collagen supplementation, since I am 100% plant-based, collagen supplements are generally from animal sources. But vitamin C is a m mandatory building block for collagen and for the processes that create the collagen. So I'm a big fan of ingesting vitamin C, and I do believe that when we eat it, it gets to the skin. It's really hard for it to remain stable in a bottle. But I do think that it would be the third step in a regimen. If you want a very simple regimen, first would be sunscreen every single day, every single day, inside and out. If you really want to be careful, you're going to also block visible light, which includes indoor lighting and light that comes through windows. So sunscreen, face, neck, chest, back of hands every day. Number two would be a retinoid, which is something from the family of vitamin A derivatives, retinol being the most common over-the-counter molecule, very powerful. Even though it's over-the-counter, it's still very, very effective and powerful. Retinoid is the family, retinol, adapalene, retinyl palmitate, retinaldehyde. Those are all of the over-the-counter retinoids. Tretinoin and tazarotene are two of the prescription retinoid creams. And just to keep it all in the family, Accutane isotretinoin is the oral vitamin A derivative that we use for severe acne. Those are all retinoids, vitamin A derivatives. That's step one and two: sunscreen, retinoid, and the retinoid goes on at night. If you're up for a third step, you would put on a topical vitamin C product in the morning. And I can't really recommend a specific one, but try to look for the more modern formulations that are stable in the package, or maybe what they call liposomal delivery systems, which means that this water soluble, think of like orange juice, water soluble molecule that you would put on your skin would actually not be able to penetrate the lipid, the fat, the oily barrier of your skin. So liposome delivery is a way to package that little water-soluble vitamin C molecule in a little envelope of molecules that can get through that lipid barrier and then deliver the vitamin C under the skin to your cells. Vitamin C may help even skin color, blotchy pigmentation, and it does trigger new collagen formation. So it's a benefit if we can figure out a way to use it.
Why do you say it has to be put on at night, the retinols?
In the old days, they found in the lab that ultraviolet rays deactivated the retinoid molecules. So, in theory, if you put it on in the morning and then went outside, the sun would deactivate it. I don't know how true that is in real life. And I know a lot of people who actually put it on twice a day, especially if you're putting it under makeup or something, it probably still protected a little bit. But I think it became a habit because of the original research showing the vulnerability to ultraviolet rays.
That's good to know. Thank you. Here's a question from Stephanie. Is this Stephanie? Yeah. And she said, when it's cold outside and I have the heat on inside, I get skin splits. I don't know what that is on my hands, normally my thumbs. The skin around them seems to get thick, but it just doesn't seem to heal. I cook everything from scratch and produce prep, so I'm constantly washing my hands. I don't like to put lotion on and have greasy hands throughout the day because I feel like it makes me wash my hands even more often to get the grease off before I touch anything. At night, I slather my hands in lotion and put on sleep gloves, but then in the morning, I feel like I have to wash my hands with soap a couple of times to get the grease off. Is it worse to wear sleep gloves with your hands in lotion overnight, but then have to wash your hands a few times with soap in the morning? Or should I just sleep with the dry skin? Any suggestions would be helpful.
Oh my goodness. This is tough because it is not really possible to heal what I assume she's saying are fissures or the deep cracks when she says
She's calling them skin splits.
the skin will split and it will crack deeply if it gets dried out. And in the winter, she says, in the winter, when it's cold and dry outside and the heat comes on inside, this gets worse. And that makes sense because in the summer, the heat is not on inside and the air outside is more humid and everything is just more, there's more humidity in the air. So this is just not as happening as severely. But what unfortunately, washing, using, cleaning, washing vegetables and putting your hands in water and touching wet food all the time. The wetness, the water, believe it or not, dries out the surface of the skin. This is what we used to, Madge used to say, dishpan hands, I guess in the 70s. And that was coming from people, of course, especially women, having their hands in water and soap all the time. The outside of the skin layer gets dried out and it will crack and it will expose the inner layers of the skin, which then also get dried out and further crack. For people who do not like the feeling of a little bit of greasiness on the fingertips, this is very, very, very difficult to manage. And going to sleep at night with a lotion and gloves is not enough to overcome it. The skin has to be completely kept out of the moisture, basically around the clock. Except for very quick hand washing after going to the bathroom or, quick showers. A thicker, greasier hand cream that is not a watery lotion that absorbs in is the only thing that's really going to help. Putting that cream on at night with the gloves, and then in the morning, trying to just tap some of the cream off the fingertips, but not try to scrub it all off because then you're undoing the progress of what that artificial barrier has created, which is allowing your own skin moisture to try to come back to the surface. That greasy hand cream is there to block additional drying from the environment while your own skin heals itself from inside. And unfortunately, there's no way around it. I would say starting day one today, big kitchen gloves for any touching of a vegetable, any touching of a dish. Don't even wash one dish without putting on the gloves. And try to get used to having that hand cream on. Get a hand cream so that it's not as greasy as Vaseline, and but it's not as watery as a lotion. Get a hand cream that feels silky. Let it be there. Wash your hand. When you wash your hands quickly, wash the germs off the outside of the cream. Do not try to scrub all of the cream off because it's too drying. So wash the germs quickly off the outside of the cream and put more cream on and just live like that for now. It'll be like another month until the weather changes. And then starting in September and October, kick up this routine again and prevent that cracking from even starting. On the fingertips, especially thumbs, when you're touching wet things, there's no way to avoid this process unless you never touch that wetness to begin with. Sorry to say.
Makes sense.
No
Makes sense.
shortcuts there.
Thank you. Okay. So next we have a question from Allie. Can Dr. Krant explain why someone may have an eczema flare after eating potatoes? That would be sad for me.
There are very, very rare but real food allergies. So, somebody who feels they may be allergic to a certain food can be tested for that. But they would have to go to an allergist and get real allergy testing. Food sensitivity testing is not reliable at this point to give us any actionable information. But I don't know if this person is eating potatoes that somebody else made and is just putting them for on a fork and into the mouth, or if this is somebody who is cooking and preparing potatoes, and it may be that touching the potatoes is creating a skin reaction that could be different from what would happen from just eating them. So all possibilities exist here, but food allergies causing a limited small rash are not that common. If you're really allergic to a food, it will usually be something that goes over your whole body.
That's interesting. Okay. I wonder, like, does it make a difference if it's organic or not, or
Right. Is it white potatoes? Is it only sweet potatoes? How are they cooked? Are they being touched? It's a lot of factors to be considered.
yeah. Nice. Okay. Do you think it's beneficial to combine PRP injections with microneedling?
I personally do not know yet whether PRP fluid makes a huge difference that is long lasting. So, for me, I do believe that PRP, which is injecting a spun down portion of your own blood under the skin, I do believe that the benefits of microneedling are at work there because we are injecting things under the skin, creating needle marks, and stretching out the tissue under the surface. I think that that is micro wounding and does trigger the healing pathway. But I don't know yet whether the PRP fluid itself makes a long-term difference compared to just the microneedling. I'm not against doing them both. I just don't know what the big difference would be for sure.
Thank you. Okay. I have areas on my face that flaky skin appears, one on each side of my upper lip and one on each side of my chin and my right eyebrow. They don't itch, burn, or hurt. When I wash my face, the flaky skin comes off. And then a couple hours later, it comes back and also goes away after a few days, but reappears a few weeks later. I had that before in my ears, but it's not reappeared for 5 months or so. But since it started to appear on my face for about a year, I don't have dandruff, but all these areas where it appear contain facial hair. I've tried over-the-counter cream ointment, but it still appears. Any suggestions?
Well, again, without looking, I am not able to begin to diagnose what could be happening. And it may be something completely different, but the description does fit the possibility that it could be small patches of facial seborrheic dermatitis, which is facial patches of what we colloquially call dandruff. Dandruff isn't only on the scalp. When that same yeast that we were talking about before, the pityrosporum, builds up, or if somebody's skin is sensitive to that yeast, even if it's a normal amount of yeast, we can get patches that are a little bit inflamed. So they may just get flaky in reaction to the inflammation, or they may actually get red and flaky. And the flaking is what happens to inflamed skin after it has been chronically inflamed for a while. The skin starts trying to repair itself and it increases cell turnover to get rid of bad cells and starts pushing off extra dry skin. But if the underlying irritation is still there, it just keeps happening. So having it be symmetrical, having it be in these hair-bearing areas, and having it been a condition that used to be in the ears or behind the ears is very classic for seborrhea. That is something that you can't really cure with over-the-counter moisturizer. But it may be that using a dandruff shampoo on the scalp for a few months will help the overall balance of yeast on the head and neck area, which may reduce the inflammatory response to the yeast that's happening on the face. Sometimes it's our immune system just starts to react to a little bit of it because there's so much of it all over. And when we reduce the burden of the yeast by killing it off or by washing our hair even just more frequently, with a regular shampoo, washing our ears to get the oils and the buildup of the yeast off the ears. Sometimes it can help. One thing that can allow seborrheic dermatitis to get worse on the face is actually a deficiency of zinc. So sometimes adding zinc into a multivitamin or using a zinc soap may also help. There are many, many, many things that can help with seborrhea, but those are just a couple of ideas.
Thank you. We have a question from Brenda. I develop warts on my feet in the exact same locations under the side of my left big toe and bottom outer side of the right foot about twice a year. They get so uncomfortable and I can hardly walk after a while. I think maybe they develop over time from my shoes. I usually wear Crocs. What is the best way to get rid of them? Do I need to change my shoes? I've tried so many others. Yeah, what causes warts? What is a
It
wart, by the way?
yes. Yes. This depends on whether these are calluses, which are just thickened skin overlying a bony area of pressure, which can be the case if shoes are rubbing the wrong way or if the toe bones are pressing into each other. It can create the skin will try to defend itself from getting eroded by creating thicker skin. That's a callus. That's a corn. When the toe is bent and the top of the toe bone is rubbing against shoes, that's a corn. Those are just nicknames for the same thing. A plantar wart, which is the wart that occurs on the bottom or the side of the foot, that is caused by a virus. That is a skin infection caused by the wart virus. And let's review that wart viruses are a giant family of viruses that are all called human papillomavirus. All warts are caused by human papillomavirus. Some HPV types create plantar wart, and plantar means bottom of the foot. So you can't have a plantar wart anywhere else because plantar means bottom of the foot. But that's caused usually by a certain type of HPV, or one or two types are common to the bottom of the foot. Warts around your cuticles of your fingers are caused by a different HPV type for the most part. Some people get flat warts on the face. They're called planar, like a flat plane, Plane. Plantar warts are caused by a different type of HPV. So true plantar warts on the foot are caused by a viral infection. And they're probably recurring twice a year because they're getting a little bit treated, but not 100% treated. So if they get 99% treated, but they're still underneath, they will grow back. So it's probably that these same little bunches of plantar wart virus are still there. And they're getting a little bit treated twice a year and then growing right back to the point where they're thicker and they're starting to hurt again. Plantar warts are extremely stubborn. I would say you want to get the aggressive home treatments with salicylic acid and just do it for a year. Or also in combination with going to your dermatologist or your podiatrist, because they are the foot doctors. And, having somebody in an office do additional treatment, probably nobody will be able to get rid of them in one treatment. It can go on for months and months and months. One day, when the skin looks and feels like regular skin with an actual footprint that has reformed and there are no dots and no bumps, and it looks like untouched foot, that may be the day that it actually is gone. That's really it. Unfortunately, there are no magic tricks for plantar warts.
Darn.
I know.
Okay. What do you think of plasma platelet-rich plasma microneedling if it's for facial wrinkles and for growing hair? And what about, I don't know any of these, charcoal facials, fibroblasts, and deep heat radiofrequency? This is somebody that knows a lot about dermatological procedures, apparently.
Right. So, I am not somebody that does a ton of these procedures. So, I really have the same theme of I definitely believe in appropriately controlled micro injury, whether with making little needle marks, needle holes from microneedling, or with controlled heat from an energy device or a laser. I do believe that this platelet-rich plasma is the PRP. I do believe that injecting this fluid that comes from our own blood is pretty safe, because it's our own molecule, so our immune system won't be triggered. But I don't know the difference for sure long term between microneedling by itself, which does create its own wound healing triggers, which does help to recreate refreshed tissue, and the difference between that and the PRP microneedling. I just don't know. Some people are massive advocates for the PRP. I'm still a little bit on the fence. In terms of regrowing hair, I do believe also that the microneedling triggers local inflammation and wound healing, which may help refresh and wake up the hair follicles and get them going again. It does bring healing molecules, refreshing wound healing molecules to the area. I don't know about microneedling or multi-needling with or without the PRP. I don't think the PRP hurts, but I'm not sure it makes a big difference. And I do know that people who use PRP to help hair growth say you have to do a series of treatments and then you probably have to do maintenance once in a while too. It's they don't claim to have it be a permanent change.
So what about the other things that were mentioned in this?
I don't know anything about charcoal in facials. And I do, fibroblasts are cells that are in our dermis. And they are the cells that, when they get stretched or when they get injured, they are the cells that recognize injury or damage and trigger. They are the cells that create collagen. So, breaking, and I think the what they do is they crush up fibroblasts and, maybe inject them or apply them to the skin, thinking they are applying or injecting more collagen production. Organelles that come from the inside of the fibroblast. I don't know really how that works in real life. I just don't know if in a live human, it will do what we think it's going to do. Of course, I'm sure it shows activity in a petri dish in a lab, but I'm very conservative on these things. You know, I'm not somebody that pushes very new science until it's been long established. And I think all of this stuff is very interesting, but I don't know yet if we've proven there's a major difference in the techniques.
Thank you. Maybe you could teach a class on learning to accept aging and the changes that come with it.
Oh, yeah, you know, I do have to figure out where I stand as somebody who is a proponent of healthy lifestyle and doing as much as we can naturally to prolong our health span, the buzzword, the new buzzword, health span. So we're healthy and vibrant as we get older, and live longer lives as long as we're healthy. We also want to look our best while we do it, but we also need to work on getting society to just settle down with the aggressive anti-aging stuff. I think it's, you know, really getting out of hand with the social media, with teenagers and you know, preteens starting to bring skincare kits and retinols to their sleepovers with their friends, and kids in college wanting Botox. I just am worried about the trend of that.
What's so interesting, I'm not going to mention any names of the vegan influencers that are quite obviously having procedures, but it is so obvious, you know, because you look at their Instagram feeds or their YouTube feeds, and one day they look like this and one day they look like that, you know?
Yeah, and but by the way, you know, it's an interesting conundrum because we don't want to judge people for, you know, looking old, but we also don't want to judge people for choosing to do things that help themselves feel better. You know, it's just not that clear of a situation, especially for women, you know, talking about it being a feminist principle to age naturally and not feel like society is pressuring you to do things. But also, it's pretty feminist to be allowed to do what you want for yourself and not have anyone tell you you shouldn't. So I, you know, it goes both ways. And I think we're still navigating it. I just think that we should really be starting to become alert to the message that's being passed down to young kids.
Well, it's like, you know, especially if you're somebody, I mean, I've been online an hour every day since my show started March 20th, 2020. And it's like, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. By the way, I've not had, I swear, and you can probably tell, I've not had any work done. If I did, would I have these? No, I've never had any kind of plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery or gastric bypass, even though I've been accused of having all of those. The thing is when you don't do it, then they tell you how old and bad you look. And then when you do it, then they tell you, well, how fake you look, you know? So you can't win. Like when I was obese, all people did was call me fat. And now all they do is call me too thin. So, you know, you can't win,
That's
basically.
what I'm saying. You know, like what happened with some of the celebrities who, you know, it looked like they had done a lot of procedures. They really got attacked and, you know, really, really viciously. But then, you know, if they don't do it, they get it, as you say, they get attacked for looking wrinkly or, you know, it's just a very complex societal puzzle that we need to figure out, because if we're going to make it past this decade into the next few hundred years, we got to figure out what we think about all this and what we're going to do about it. I'm a proponent for healthy lifestyle and, you know, not thinking you can skip over the healthy lifestyle and just fix things with procedures. I think that it's really important to at least be helping yourself from the inside out if you also want to do some other things too.
You know, it's funny because we recently had the Oscars, and I thought like the best looking person there was Jodie Foster. And I don't know if she's had work or not. I'm assuming maybe she didn't. She wears minimal makeup, and I thought like she was like gorgeous.
I just watched her show, you know, that she was in this past year, and it's fun to see her. It's fun to see women aging, you know, more naturally and being proud of it. I just love it. I think they're fantastic role models because we do need that counterbalance.
Yeah, it's interesting. Time for one more push-up.
Sure.
Thank you. This is it's funny. It just says JK, which coincidentally are your initials. Okay, so I don't think you sent in a question for yourself. My nephew has very bad rosacea with large red patches and blemishes. What do you suggest for your patients who don't have success with topical treatments and don't want to constantly be on antibiotics? What diet do you recommend for it? And what else can you do for patients who have a persistent case?
I do not have any nephews, so that is definitely not me. And I would first like to say that I really believe that rosacea is one of those terms like eczema that is sort of a catch-all word we use to describe what ultimately is many, many different conditions. I think what we call rosacea, we say there are six or seven types, but I really believe that in some way those might all be individual. Different skin conditions, and we call them all rosacea. So when somebody's saying my nephew has rosacea and it's patchy, I don't know if that's even rosacea because I've had a lot of patients come to me and say, "Oh, I have rosacea. My doctor said I have rosacea." And it turns out that what their other doctor thought was rosacea, I think is something entirely different. It could be keratosis pilaris, rubra facie. It could be pityriasis dermatitis. It could be something else. So I don't know if it's rosacea, but I would say if it is many forms of what we call is real rosacea, that one of the first things that people don't realize is that rosacea is primarily a condition of a disrupted skin barrier, which means irritated, inflamed skin barrier that not only allows moisture to be lost through the surface of the skin in what we call transepidermal water loss, shortened as TEWL. Rosacea loses a lot of moisture through the skin, which prevents the skin from settling down to heal itself. And this damaged barrier, microscopically irritated and damaged skin barrier that doesn't appear damaged on the surface, allows irritants of any product. Any gentle cream can even include something that irritates a rosacea-prone skin. So that just perpetuates the cycle of the patchy inflammation. I think calming the skin, healing the skin, protecting the barrier are vital baseline steps. On top of that, there are so many topicals that can be helpful, but some work for some people and not for others. And others work for those people, but not for the original people. So not wanting to use, not thinking anything works may be because everything is irritating the skin because the barrier isn't healed at baseline. And also, it may be that the right things haven't been tried or haven't been tried long enough. Some people can get frustrated after using a routine for 2 weeks, but it may take 2 months or 3 months to really heal the skin and get the cycle of inflammation to stop. I could go on and on about rosacea. I don't know if I answered the question.
Thank you. I know they said last one, but I just found one more, if you don't mind, really quickly.
Okay.
Thanks from Danny. Looking for healthy home remedies, no prescriptions for minor skin irritations that flare up here and there, like red spots, rashes, or just skin blemishes. I'm whole food plant-based for 2 years, 66 years young. Any ideas would be appreciated. Home.
Well, two
Yeah.
things come to mind right away. One is the little silicone gel patches that are now being sold in drugstores. Those are just hydrating barriers, very thin little stickers that you can put on a pimple or on a little rash. And if hydration alone and reducing inflammation will help the skin issue, those patches may be beneficial. It does, like I said, it helps put an artificial barrier over the outside of the skin to allow the skin to heal itself. Once that barrier is damaged, the skin sometimes just can't catch up and fix itself. So those little silicone patches help. Some of those silicone patches have medicine in them, so watch out for that. Salicylic acid is a medicine that can help acne pimples sometimes. But the plain silicone patches that have no medicine may be of benefit. The other thing is, really high grade honey. Now, if you're vegan and you don't believe in using honey, this wouldn't be an option. But some vegans are okay with honey that's ethically sourced, because we do want to increase the bee population in the world. So there are arguments in both directions. But honey, natural honey, has been shown to help heal wounds and reduce inflammation. So that's another option.
I never heard of silicone patches. What are they and where do you get them?
There, it's interesting because it's come from a many decades old type of a bandage that we've had in healthcare for a long time called hydrocolloid. So there are the waterproof bandages like Band-Aid brand and other brands, Curad. Waterproof bandages are hydrocolloid. They seal all the way around and they keep the wound area moist. And that allows your skin to heal itself. The silicone, little tiny, thin silicone patches are a thinner version of what's been sold for a while for scars. Silicone gel sheets for scars and silicone liquid to paint on scars has been around for a while. I don't think we understand fully why silicone gel helps scars, except that I think it helps protect the outside of the skin so the skin can remodel itself from the inside. And the same thing, they just started making these very tiny, thin little stickers for acne pimples and little patches of eczema that may help calm the skin and help it heal itself.
I see. I've seen people wear these. I don't know what they are. Like, I guess they're for wrinkles. Like you put them on at night. You know what I'm talking about? Those.
Oh, yes. So the original brand of those was called
That's
Frownies,
right, frowny. Did they?
because
Do
you
they?
would put them right here and go to sleep. But now they make them for under the eyes and other areas. Same idea. That's that same silicone gel sheet. All it does is allow your skin to hydrate itself. Normally moisture will try to leak out through the skin, and then we lose it by evaporating sweat through the surface, even microscopically. We're losing moisture through our skin all the time. So sealing those areas with silicone gel sheets, which are removable and reusable, prevents that water that's trying to come to the surface from getting out. So it just makes that skin there more juicy. As soon as you take off the silicone gel, that water starts escaping. So it's just a temporary little protection.
Yeah, that's great. That'd be so cool if you did a whole show on what works and what doesn't.
I wish I knew the science behind all of it. And I wish I knew the things that were real and everything that wasn't real and had perfect knowledge. But I will continue to share everything I learn and also what I think as we go. I give a lot of my opinions, so I'm sure other people feel differently about some of these procedures or maybe know more than I do. But I like to just be cautious.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Dr. Krant.
Thanks for having me, Chef AJ. Can't wait to come
Oh, it's
back.
so great seeing you. And thanks all of you for your great questions and for watching another episode of Chef AJ Live. Please come back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Pacific time for Plant Fueled with Dr. Nikki Davis. She's going to be making smashed chickpea lettuce boats. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.